Hello and welcome to another episode of IEF Talk. I'm Bettina Solinger. I'm the head of the International Academy for Leadership in Gummersbach, Germany. And today I sit at a big table together with my four wonderful guests, Arpita Nepal, Rainer Heufers, Professor Andrew Morris, and Dr. Tom Palmer. I would like to ask you to introduce yourselves before we dive into a conversation around market economy and environmental issues, amongst others. And Arpita, would you like to set us off, please?
Thank you, Bettina. So, hello, everyone. It's good to join you, and thank you for joining us on the podcast. My name is Arpita Nepal. I run a think tank in Nepal called Samriddhi Foundation. It's a free market think tank, largely working on economic policies. And the reason I'm here at IEF is to refresh myself by meeting young people who are inspired by free market ideas every day. So to recharge my batteries, to be honest.
It's a pleasure for me to be here as well. My name is Rainer Heufers. I am based in Indonesia, where I also, like Arpita, run a public policy think tank called the Center for Indonesian Policy Studies. And the reason why I'm in Indonesia in the first place is because the Fridtjof Naumann Foundation sent me there as their project director, which is by now a long time ago. I've since left the foundation, but not completely, because I'm still running seminars for the IAF here in Gummersbach, and it's always a pleasure to come back and lead these programs. Thanks for having me here.
It's a pleasure.
So I'm Andy Morris. I'm a professor at Texas A&M University in Texas. I'm an economist and a lawyer, and I've been working on a variety of regulatory and economic liberty and environmental issues for a long time. And I met Arpita in Hong Kong when in a program many, many years ago. And I met Rainer at Universidad Francisco Marroquín in Guatemala. So I think I'm here because I didn't annoy either of them sufficiently for them not to
not
invite
yet,
me.
Not yet.
Anyway, so we'll see if I'm on a train by the end of the podcast.
Well, thank you again, Bettina, for this assembling this group. My name is Tom Palmer, and I get to work with Atlas Network, which is a global network of over 500 think tanks, like two that we've heard described, in 102 different countries. And I'm on the road constantly and meeting with people, and it was great to come back to the magic mountain of liberty here in at the Naumann program in the Theodor Heuss Akademie. And this is a great opportunity to refresh my batteries and recharge and meet young people who are enthusiastic about the future of liberty.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. Well, we thought about and talked about and debated ideas around market economy and how to benefit from markets and explore maybe where are the limits also, or the alleged limits. And Andrew, you just gave the cue already towards the environment. It's often in debates you hear that, you know, markets are actually the enemy of the environment, and where you have market economy or leave it to the market, then the environment loses out on this, and climate change being a huge challenge for mankind will also lose out with markets and with economic growth. So I would love to start with exploring your take on markets and the environment.
Right. I think the idea that markets are the enemy of the environment is a really old-fashioned, outdated idea that came out of the experience of the 1960s, when you looked at a big smokestack or putting out smoke, or a pipe putting things out, and said, well, here's wasteful activity going on. And where we actually see the success in solving environmental problems is where people have been able to harness markets to address it. When you're throwing something away, there's an opportunity there. And the environmental problems we face today, many of which are much more complex and difficult, like climate change, than we've faced in the past, really require this sort of amount of human creativity that markets excel at bringing to bear on things. So I think instead of seeing markets as an enemy and something to be controlled, it's better to see them as an opportunity and an engine that can harness human creativity towards solving problems, which is, after all, what they do every day in the economic sphere.
I can contribute just a story, because this is an issue that is so important in Indonesia. Some of you must have seen documentaries about the biodiversity, the animals, and, for example, also the birds of Indonesia in Papua, the birds of paradise, beautiful. They live in these forests, rainforests, and these rainforests are owned by nobody, or rather the government, with the effect that people would go into these forests, because human encroachment is there, we're getting closer and closer to the animals, and they would catch these birds and sell them in the market. So we now have a real problem that these very beautiful birds are slowly moving towards extinction because they're being caught by people and sold in the markets. How different would it be if there were some property rights on the rainforests, and not to turn them into industrial estates, but to conserve them, and to make sure these birds stay where they are so that we can have tourists going, we can have a little bit of profit coming out of this and enabling the conservation of these forests.
Yeah, I think the debate, at least on the academic level, was brought forward by Eleanor Ostrom's work. But practically speaking, we in Nepal also have had this experience with community forestry. It's a success story around the world. But the underlying thing is the recognition that for a common property, you need to clearly delineated property rights to be able to take advantage, or even for conservation, because we went from deforestation around 1970s to about 45% area coverage, land area coverage of forests by 2010. So it's an incredible story of how communities came together after having property rights. But the benefits is only not with regards to conservation. It's also to the communities, because they were able to use these forests for their own economic advantage. So while we didn't have local government in Nepal for the longest period of time, I think we didn't have elections for 20 years during the conflict. And so during this time, it was the community forestry users group which actually functioned as pseudo-local governments and provided all the public services. So I think the sense of empowerment that it brings into just the communities as well, it's a wonderful way of managing common resources.
Property rights are also such an effective way of causing people to be responsible for their behavior, because they have to bear the costs of it. So when we think about the waterways in Scotland that are privately owned, so the actual fishery there is owned by someone, if someone were to go and dump a lot of trash into it, someone would pop up and say, you can't do that in our river. This belongs to us, and we reap benefits from it in terms of the salmon fishing and trout and other sorts of activities. That's a way to make other people responsible. But if it doesn't belong to anyone, no one has the right to stop you from dumping garbage in it. And that's what we should expect people to do. The alternative method of dealing with environmental amenities has some problems. It assumes that a ministry in the capital it will be responsible for these things. So that assumes that there's an alignment of interest, that the minister or the staff really care about this and are concerned about it. Well, maybe and maybe not. And it also presumes that they have the knowledge of it, that they know what's going on. Well, it's very different from the people who live there. If they own it, they're directly affected by the behavior. They have the knowledge that is missing in the far distant capital. And if they have property rights, they have the legal means and tools to be able to defend their interests. So property may not be the answer to every problem in the world. We don't know about the global warming and so on. But it's a tool that solves a lot of problems. Unfortunately, some people have thought, well, if it doesn't solve every problem I can imagine, throw it away. Yeah. But that's like saying that because you can't use a hammer or a screwdriver to cut something, we should throw them away and never use them for anything. Property rights is a really great social tool for solving lots and lots of problems. And environmental problems are right at the top of the list.
So one more point along those lines, the philosopher David Schmitz has written about the phenomenon of bleach fishing on coral reefs, where fishermen would pour bleach in the water. It suffocates the fish, they die and float to the surface, and they scoop them up. It also kills the coral reef, and so then there's not going to be any more fish. And so academics puzzle over how could someone behave so destructively of their environment and so forth. And Schmitz points out the fisherman has a choice between bleach fishing or starving tomorrow. But there's no choice of leaving the fish, because if he doesn't do it, someone else will. And so the only way you preserve it is by property rights or sort of 24-hour armed guards protecting the resource. So when you privatize it, as Tom said, you create someone who has an interest in preserving the resource. And that person then can benefit from it. Now, there's some trade-offs to all these things, if there is to anything. But in general, if we want someone to care about something, they need to own it.
We've seen very practical applications of that in fisheries. Iceland, New Zealand, they have the individual transferable quotas, which means that the fishers who are no longer subsidized by the state to overfish as they were before, they own it. They own a share of the catch. And if they overcatch, it means fewer fish next year. They have an incentive to maximize that fish stock and not fish them all out tomorrow. Prior to this, it was a free-for-all. Everyone went in, scooped up fish, and the consequence is no more fish in the future if you don't leave enough to reproduce. If you have a property system, you end up with a sustainable catch. It's really the sustainable policy, and it has been tremendously successful where we've seen fish stocks rising. Unfortunately, other parts of the world that don't have this, take the coast of much of Africa, for example, where there are not developed property rights, it's very difficult to exclude foreign trawlers who can come in and scoop up massive amounts of fish and then depart. Those areas are basically being fished out. It's a real disaster. And the only solution we have so far that has been proven to work is a property rights solution.
I didn't know we had so many fishery experts here, but let me share a story as well, because we have been dealing with, of course, with this, of course, in Indonesia, which is a very large fish producing country. And it came to the point where the question was, how do we sustain the fish stock in and around Indonesia? So it came up to sustainable fisheries. But when you look at it, it is usually Western companies, supermarket chains, that need to put a label sustainably fished onto their tins of tuna. And the way they do that would be that the fishermen in Indonesia, for example, would get reduced quota that they have to commit to so that it can be claimed as this has been sustainably fished. But the profit, the entire profit, goes to the supermarket chain basically in the West. What is not considered in this model is the property rights of the local fishermen. Now what you have in New Zealand is they have given the property rights to the fisheries, to the Maori communities, the indigenous communities. They could use their customary laws and everything to regulate the fishing in the areas, in the waters around New Zealand. And this has been a tremendous success. They incorporated under the Maori communities, and they have taken this over, and they have flourished because they were able to sell their fish to these supermarket chains. So in Indonesia, we don't have that yet. We don't have the indigenous communities getting organized so that they can actually regulate themselves in the way they want to deal with their fishing in the local waters. That, I think, would be real progress if they had the property rights to sell their own fish.
Could it be that one problem with, or the bad image of property rights is also that people associate it with pseudo-feudal property distribution, so that the big ones sell, buy, or coerce people out of their property and take it, and then when they own a lot, maybe they don't take care as much as a community would, whose livelihood also depends on how they treat the property and to make it sustainable for themselves and future generations.
Well, I think it depends. There's different experiences in different countries, but in some areas the colonial experience was such a trauma for local communities, as we all understand very well. And some people came to identify, these property rights were brought to us by the Europeans, as if the indigenous law didn't have property rights. This is simply not the case. They took different forms. One of the problems in much of the world now is that you have sometimes a formal property structure that may be based on French civil code, for example, but it doesn't correspond to the customary law that actually governs how people behave in the community. This is a very dysfunctional legal system. And you're much better off if you listen to the community law, to the customary law, and then allow that to be formalized so it's made more transparent to people outside of the community, which widens the circle of cooperation. Property is fundamentally a form of cooperation, and this is what many people don't understand. Marx and others understood property to mean a form of opposition, me against you. The property was the basis for an antagonistic society. And I think that's a fundamental misunderstanding. Property is the foundation on the basis of which people can voluntarily cooperate. I know what's yours. You know what is mine. The rights are clearly defined. We have a baseline for mutually beneficial cooperation. When we don't know what is yours and what is mine, we will come into conflict. That is simply inevitable. So property is a mechanism for increasing social cooperation. And I think this is a communication matter that good economists, Andy, for example, is a great economist, great storyteller also. We need more people like that to explain the way in which property facilitates cooperation.
I think like also the feudalism debate relies a lot on populist rhetoric, which is what we hear quite a lot in our part of the world. And it's interesting because we've just done a research right now on land holdings within Nepal. And we're looking at if owning a large tracts of land, according to the political rhetoric, apparently the feudals have captured all the power in Nepal. And so what we did is we're looking at a study where if you own large tracts of land, what happens to your children's social mobility? You know, occupationally, do they do better? Educationally, do they better or not? It so turns out, at least through our evidence, that if you hold large tracts of agricultural land, it holds your children back. So they're not moving up in the social ladder. So the question of property rights is, I think, not just looking at property rights in isolation, but also whether there is the mechanism within your country to be able to use that property right for economic benefits. So in the case of community forestry, it's the community coming together and they were able to turn it into economic opportunities for the whole community. Whereas if you just hold large tracts of land, for example, in rural areas of Nepal, no bank is willing to lend you on the basis of that. There is no bankability, and which means you're just stuck with a large piece of land. You're always stuck in agriculture. So really, we also have to look at mechanisms of property rights transformation. You know, property rights, of course, titles matter, but titles only matter when they are bankable, when they can be used in the economy. So I think, you know, looking at even when granting property rights in the common resource pool, we really have to look at mechanisms where eventually people are able to use that for economic benefit rather than just granting property rights. Like, that's why I think involving community to a certain extent sort of takes care of that problem.
I think you both brought up really important points about property, which is that property is a part of an embedded set of social relationships that makes the rules clear, as you were describing, Tom, right? So that it avoids conflict because now I know this boundary is there. And if you want me to cooperate, you'll have to persuade me to bring my property into the joint venture. But you have to see this as part of an entire network of relationships that exist. And so sometimes reformers make the mistake of coming in and say, well, we'll just write down who owns what, and you know, we'll trust maybe this interpreter who's maybe not very trustworthy, and so we get the things wrong. Or you get, in colonialism, people came in and just sort of took property without seeing if anybody else owned it already or if there was some sort of local institution that regulated access to it. But setting aside problems of sort of making amends for those past things, going forward, if we want to take care of the land and the water and so forth, we want those things to be taken care of, somebody has to take care of them. And the best person to take care of them is usually the person who owns them. Because even if that person isn't the best person, right, someone else who values that thing will come along and bid those resources away, will buy them from that person because they see an opportunity that the other person doesn't. So we have a lot of examples in the U.S. of very successful business people developing an interest in protecting the environment. So Ted Turner is a good example of this, someone who made a lot of money in broadcasting and so forth. And then he became very interested in restoration of the environment in Montana, and he bought up large tracts of land in Montana and invested enormous amounts of his own money, that much more than any government would have ever been willing to put in, at eradicating invasive species, restocking with native species, restoring streams and rivers to sort of, you know, more pristine condition, restoring species, developing a herd of buffalo. Now, he also developed a series of restaurants that sell buffalo meat, right? So there's an economic sustainability to this that's not just based on charity, but has led to significant improvements in the areas where he owns land. Now, that's sometimes uncomfortable for people, because one of the things he does is he puts a fence up and says, you can't come on my land because I'm restoring it. And people were used to treating this land as if it was common property, but now it's not. But if we accept the idea that lots of people like that, trying lots of strategies, we're going to find better solutions out of all of those experiments than we will from some central government official making a decision possibly based on political considerations rather than on environmental ones.
Since you are from Texas, Andy, there's a gentleman who had the sole, what's that called, license to... There was a gentleman who made a lot of money with importing Toyota cars to Texas, and really grew a substantial amount of wealth. And he liked hunting, so he went to Tanzania and he got a lease of a certain amount of land, big amount of land, where he went hunting. He liked that. But then the local people said to him at one point, and I know because I spoke to those local people, I stayed at that land, they said to him, listen, instead of coming here and shooting these animals, you can actually make some money out of this by turning this into a tourist destination, because we have all these animals here. And after a while, they said it took them a while to convince him. It worked. So the villagers that were there were usually poachers, because the guy from Texas came to shoot the animals, so they also thought they'd go in to shoot the animals. So they were poachers, so I had to persuade them to actually stop the poaching. The way to do that was to hire them as personnel for the lodge that they built for the tourists. They built a school for the kids of the children, so basically to make them feel that they benefit from the whole thing. And then they built this beautiful lodge, and my wife and I went, and we had holidays there, and we enjoyed all the leopards and all the, you know, the impalas and lions and so on that were on that land, a vast amount of land. Because at one point that person decided to actually protect the environment there. And this is not just it, you know, it's a limited amount of land. It's big, but it's still limited. And you do need, of course, animals to migrate between places, which is not really possible anymore with infrastructure and urbanization. So there is now a great exchange organized for profit to exchange giraffes from one conservation area to the other. They trade in buffaloes, they trade in lions, etc. So if you feel that your lion stock is getting too old and the gene pool is too limited, you trade your lions with the other conservation areas and back and forth. And this is a for-profit exchange of these animals. And it works across all the conservation areas in Namibia, in Tanzania, and in all these countries. It's amazing what for-profit enterprises do for nature in Africa.
So there's a similar story, although with a less happy ending. In the Cayman Islands, there was a wealthy British businessman who had some business interests there, and he became very interested in preserving sea turtles. And so in Cayman, turtling is a traditional occupation for men. People eat turtle. There's like 37 different words for different cuts of turtle meat, whereas you and I might have one. So it's an integral part of the local culture. But they were being hunted to extinction by poachers who were not observing the quotas scientists thought necessary to preserve them. So this British businessman built a turtle farm. And so they captured some turtles. They built tanks. It was a fairly primitive operation at first, and they collected some eggs. And so you figure out of 100 turtle eggs that are laid naturally on the beach, maybe 4 or 5 of them grow to maturity because some are eaten on the beach as they're crawling to the sea for the first time, or eaten when they're very young. And so he reasoned that by raising the eggs, the turtles in captivity at first, you could preserve them until they were big enough to survive on their own. So they could release 90 turtles and eat 10, and the environment's still is better off, and there's still there's plenty of turtle meat. And so he hired the poachers because they understood turtles to do this. So he reduced poaching. This proved to be a success. The turtle meat was being shipped to Europe, where there's a market for turtle soup, apparently, especially in France. And all was going well until the Convention on Trade in Endangered Species kicked in, and these were endangered species. And so the U.S. had ratified that and said, you can't ship the meat through Miami, which was the only airport with a refrigerated shipping capacity. So it killed the farm as a for-profit enterprise. The Canadian government ended up buying it and sort of operates it as a sort of tourist destination and for research purposes. But it was originally economically sustainable, and it was adding to the turtle population significantly out of a profit motive.
I actually had a point to that, because that's a really interesting case study. Sir Anthony Fisher was the one behind that. And he not only did that, he learned how to breed sea turtles and get more eggs. They returned eggs to places that hadn't seen eggs in very many years, so they were repopulating beaches because the turtles always come back to the same beach. They have little GPS installed in them so they can come back to that beach. And he was able to basically wipe out the demand, the illegal demand for the hawksbill turtle, which has a particularly notable shell that has this brown mottled color, because by giving the normal sea turtles he had a different diet, the shells became indistinguishable. And so even the shells were able to be out there legally, and it wiped out the demand for this diminishing population of endangered turtles. From an environmental perspective, this is a win-win all around. Unfortunately, Jerry Brown, who was governor of California at the time, said, well, I see it, it's the turtles against the businessman, and I'm for the turtles. Well, the consequence was there was no one there to replenish the turtle population and to take care of them. This ended up being extremely foolish. There are other examples of that where people don't think through the consequences of these emotional decisions they make. Where I live in Thailand, we have elephant populations around us, and some people say, oh, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't have an elephant farm or allow people to ride elephants. And I agree, there are some ethical concerns about mistreatment, and those need to be addressed. But I also ask, I say, you know, if no one comes to the places where the elephants are to observe them or even to ride on them, how will the elephants eat? During COVID, it was very bad when there were no tourists, and the elephant owners couldn't feed them. So if we want there to be elephants, we have to have some mechanism to make sure that people have an incentive to keep them and to feed them and to take care of them. Even if it's not the optimal picture we have of the wild planet covered by wild elephants, let's at least make sure that they don't go extinct because people foolishly act on what they consider their superior motives.
Yeah, so there are a lot of examples, all from the seaside up to now, or near the beaches. But when you leave the more tangible world and you think about carbon dioxide, I mean, who you said, you know, if someone has a property of something, then they take care. So what about the climate? What about carbon dioxide? Is working with property rights or markets a solution for that?
Well, we need to be thinking about incentives for people to change their behavior. That's really the key that opens the door. Property rights is one way of aligning people's incentives. Very effective. Distributed intelligence doesn't require a brilliant, genius, wonderful, all-knowing central planner. So it's a very robust response. How it would apply in this case is a bit unclear to me. But whatever solution that we take, and of course cap and trade and markets in emissions is one market type of solution, it needs to be one that gives people incentives to act differently than they have been acting. That's the key. Many people have this, I think, fantasy mentality. We'll pass a law called the Clean Environment Law. Mission accomplished. We won. We passed the Clean Environment Law. But they didn't create incentives that led people to change their behavior. people often think, and some of my friends even have this attitude, well, the only thing that changes behavior is the threat of punishment. It's a really kind of primitive view when you think about it. Only the fear of being thrown into a dungeon or beaten or deprived of my freedom or executed will change behavior. That's simply wrong. There are positive incentives as well. People act in order to achieve reputation, to be liked by other people, and also to make money, to get prestige. All of those positive incentives can be put to work as well. So an incentive approach, I think, is really the ground foundation for a realistic approach, unless what people think is, well, I don't care what happens, I just want to feel good about myself by posturing. And unfortunately, there's a lot of that in the world, left and right both. Posturing without thinking about what will induce people to change their behavior. And sometimes those positive incentives, like Andy talked about, the old profit motive, there's money to be made in this, can cause people to act in a way that's aligned with the interests of others.
So I think there's a couple possible avenues to explore in terms of how to address climate problems. So one, as Tom said, the key is aligning incentives to get the behavior that we want. So that means taking an approach that sort of gives people an incentive to adapt their behavior, but let them figure out how best to adapt it. So I can I'd say, for example, if you wanted to tax gasoline and diesel fuel based on its carbon content, that would be a better approach than mandating the replacement of internal combustion engines with electric vehicles, right? Electrical vehicles have their own problems. And so you want people to be operating on the margin to move. So you can always take a sort of more market signaling approach rather than a command and control approach. But more importantly, one of the fundamental problems we face with climate change, which is happening whether we do anything, take any particular measures or not, the climate is going to be changing. So we need to adapt. And one of the things that's really important about how we adapt is having the right information about what's happening right here. Right, so this facility, this lovely facility we're in, choices have to be made probably about replacing the HVAC system periodically and things like that. And if you had sort of better information about the trend for the local climate, not the global climate, but the local climate, you would be in a position to make choices about that and say whether a particular investment was worthwhile or so forth. Whether you're making an investment in a place like Miami that's subject to extreme weather risks is another thing. These are incredibly difficult predictions to make based on the state of the knowledge now. We have a much better capacity to predict global level things, like saying the global average climate will rise by X degrees if we don't change our behavior, than we have as saying what's going to happen right here. And that's because those modeling questions are really hard. They're very, very difficult, but we've made a lot of progress in the past 30, 40 years or so. The Netherlands, for example, has been an incredible pioneer, and they have there's a great paper by a Dutch statistician called Fighting the Enemy with Mathematics, which was about calculating the optimal height of seawalls in the Netherlands to deal with rising ocean levels, right? And so we need to incentivize people to do that. Well, it turns out there's a way to do it. Here's my chance to talk about insurance. So in the alternative risk transfer market, there are something called catastrophe bonds, which are being sold, which is a way to bring the large amount of capital in the world capital markets into insurance, right? So right, if you just looked at the insurance market, you're looking at the total market capitalization of insurance companies and reinsurance companies. That's so much smaller than global capital markets. So insurance companies logically said, how can we get more of that giant amount of capital deployed to deal with extreme weather risks? And so they set about designing bonds that pay off to the bond. So I'm a pension fund, say, and I invest $10 million in this bond. I'm going to get paid monthly interest payments. And then if, say, a hurricane does not hit Miami and cause a certain amount of damage in the next 5 years, I get my money back. However, if a hurricane does hit Miami and cause that much damage, the insurance company that sold the bond gets at least some of the money, or perhaps all of it, depending on how much damage has occurred. So now we have an incentive by the people offering the bond to accurately predict hurricanes, right? A really hard problem. Well, there are now at least three different modeling firms globally deploying, dozens of very sophisticated analysts working on improving the predictability, because you have to predict accurately to get the pricing right on that bond. And just being a little bit better than your competitor gets you an incredible advantage in that. And we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars of bond sales. Now, this is a huge market globally. And so we've deployed an enormous amount of talent at zero cost to the public. Right? You could do this with the government. The government could hire huge, vast numbers of civil servants to work on this problem. And they could commission university professors to work on it, all that kind of stuff, at great cost. But we haven't spent a dime of public money to do this. And yet we have materially advanced the ability to predict hurricanes in the last 20 years as a result of the existence of these financial instruments, which also benefit retirees in California whose public... the California Public Employees Retirement System invests in these things as a way of diversifying their portfolio. So it's not just stocks and bonds. It's also these catastrophe bonds. The World Bank has used these to address drought conditions in Africa. Typically, when you get a drought, which we expect more sort of variation in weather, we don't know quite how it's going to happen, but when you have a drought, someone has to notice the drought, so that takes some time. So the people on the ground notice the drought first, but then eventually an aid agency notices the drought and determines there is a drought and gathers some data and then starts going around to government saying, we really need you to put in more money for drought relief. And that takes time. Maybe some celebrities hold a concert. That takes time. So maybe 18 months after the drought starts, some aid money starts to flow. With this catastrophe bond that the World Bank designed, the money would be there immediately. As soon as the drought trigger is hit, the money is dispersed. And that's where markets can dramatically improve our ability to adapt to a changing world. And the world's going to change, the climate's going to change no matter what we do. I mean, if we took radical action on restricting future emissions starting tomorrow, we would still have increased the level of greenhouse gases in the system, and temperature would likely still rise for some period of time, right? It's going to take time, so we have to adapt. So I think what markets are really good at is adaptation. That's what they do. And so being able to deploy that is going to make all of us better off and better able to live in a world that's going to be different 20 years from now than it is now. And so I'm now a grandparent. I want my granddaughters to live in a world in which the world is adaptable. I want them to live in a richer world as well. And so I want us to only do things that work, and I want us to do things that make the world a better place so that they'll have a better life than I did. And I think that's possible if we adopt a use markets to address these problems. It's not possible if we don't. And so it matters a lot to me, even though I'm not likely to be here in 50 years, that the world be a better place in 50 years, because I want my granddaughters to live in that world.
I see your point, Andy. I try to translate it into the reality of where I live, in Indonesia. Agriculture there is confronted with dramatic changes in rainfall and the temperatures. So the question is how to adapt. So exactly that question. And one of the solutions is insurance. But the problem is that insurance basically is an agreement that I pay on a regular basis, trusting that when I hit the problems and the catastrophe, it'll be paid back to me. And since the insurance system hasn't reached rural areas of Indonesia yet, they're not used to this, neither to health insurance nor nothing of that sort, it's very hard for them to believe that if they pay today, they might get something in the future. And let me just finish that thought, because I do believe there need to be solutions along these lines. And what the government does is they invite the global insurers to advise how can we come up with weather-indexed insurances for the farmers, etc. I don't think it can work, because it's a central government solution together with global insurance companies. I think this requires local solutions, because it has to work with the customs and the traditions locally, that the people really trust, and trust is, of course, a very precious good, that they actually trust the solution that they're subscribing to and paying for. And that really requires entrepreneurship. We need local solutions for that. This requires locally adapted insurance solutions that really might only work on one part of Indonesia and not in the other ones.
So you're absolutely right. These solutions have to be adapted to local conditions, but I don't really see that as a problem, right? There are entrepreneurs, you work with many of them in Indonesia that can work on this. There is a local, in Malaysia, there's a special district, Labuan, that is very important in the captive insurance space and is a perfect vehicle for a Southeast Asian approach to developing solutions, right? They have the sort of regulatory framework in place. They've built up the expertise to sort of monitor solutions like this. We now have technology. I was talking with a friend who works in sort of the weather derivative space, designing financial instruments based on weather, and they can distinguish between very small plots of land and measuring the impact of a weather event in terms of like some drought conditions and things like that. And so he just sort of to show me what he could do, he pulled up a map of Kansas and sort of concocted a formula that would pay out based on what this particular plot sort of a protein cover was relative to sort of averages and the distance to the nearest place that had sufficient protein that you could likely buy alternative sources for your animals. And then he did that sort of on a lark in you know, 30 minutes. So I think that you could deploy solutions like this. You just need a good Indonesian entrepreneur. And if only I knew someone who could identify such an entrepreneur and help them get connected. And the size of even though individual Indonesian farmers are not, each individual farmer is not a huge market, somebody's making money selling those farmers all sorts of stuff and packaging the insurance in that. Is another way around this. So one of the ways to get around the problem of the farmers is maybe this comes with your seeds, right? You don't have to buy the insurance. It's just part of the deal when you get your seed crop, right? So this is guaranteed that if certain weather conditions occur, you'll get a payment. That doesn't require any trust at that point by the farmer. They're not paying anything extra for it as far as they can tell. And then they get a check or some cash or whatever it is. And they you build up. Build up that way. All these markets, by the way, all these alternative risk markets didn't exist 30 years ago. And somebody thought of them and built them into huge financial markets in a very short time. So I'm pretty confident that if governments got out of the way, these kinds of solutions could be deployed in places that we can't even think of, even if we each drank a whole bottle of wine tonight and got out the whiteboard.
So I understand with this insurance or these alternative risk insurances, they drive science to get better data, better information, to be able to better adapt to a changing environmental or climate situation. But it won't help with the climate in the long run. I'm still searching for how can markets actually under support the reduction of carbon dioxide and other drivers of warming, because methane and other gases are some are even worse. So carbon dioxide is not the only problem, because it. The major trend, and you said we can see global trends easier than what is happening in a plot of land. So the global trend goes towards a much higher temperature for the planet, which also has consequences in the long run with the poles melting and the ice on the poles melting, causing all kinds of problems elsewhere. That's something that really people, it instills, it triggers fear in people. Some are panicking. We know it's a rather slow thing that is happening, but it's pretty steady. And the idea is that if we don't do something drastically now, the window of opportunity is gone. And the only thing that we can do in future generation is to adapt even further on even smaller space that is left, that is where you can live.
It raises a lot of questions.
Yes.
that many environmentalists have found uncomfortable. Nuclear power is one of them, where you don't have the problem of the emissions and the carbon dioxide. Are we able to move into a situation where this is a safer technology? I'm not an expert in this field, but it's my understanding that they're much safer than they were in the past. And moreover, even the worst nuclear disasters turned out not to have the impact that many people associate them with. I think there's an unfortunate connection in the minds of many people between atomic power and atomic weapons, which we know are hideously destructive and do need to be controlled. And so somehow they're viewed as equally dangerous. And I think this is very, very unfortunate. In those systems, we do need to come up with ways of accountability and safety measures. But I think that looking at nuclear again is a reasonable option. And then also looking at the ways in which electricity markets and power generation have been deliberately made inefficient by governmental policy. For instance, the restrictions on cogeneration of electricity in many places. It's considered a monopoly, sometimes a state monopoly, or a monopoly of a utility company that has special privileges. And so if you produce electricity in your own use and put it to work, it can be illegal in some places because the state is the monopoly electricity provider. More people are escaping this as they install solar power and other sorts of things. But for so long, the socialist mentality was electricity has to be a monopoly. Only one institution, whether it's directly owned by the state or effectively chartered by the state, is allowed to produce it. And the consequence was a huge amount of energy went to waste in the form of heat and other things escaping from other processes. So finding ways for people to put that to work would be a good start. I'm not going to say it's the only solution or that I know all the answers to this problem, but there are so many bad policies that could be changed that would lead to more efficient energy use and use that would have a lower footprint around the world. Cap and trade is another useful thought where you have a situation you can say, look, we're going to limit the release to this level, but then we're going to find who is the most efficient user of that. That leads to a much better system. There's one other element coming up here that we should pay attention to, and that is that these environmental issues are of greater interest, and let's just be frank about this, to people who are wealthy enough to care about them. Much of the world that is mired in poverty, people are not focused on these questions. They're worried about putting food on the table. They're worried about making sure that their children don't die in infancy and so on. The concern about the environment is very much a feature of rising wealth and people being able to consider these other environmental amenities. So once you are not starving, you're not in fear of your life, you're not worried about the things that my parents and their parents and so on were worried about, and I'm not as worried about today, they're now able to take account of these other wider environmental amenities. So the environmental movement itself is something that was called into being by rising wealth. And we should not forget that. A wealthier world is a world in which people are more concerned, not less, about environmental amenities. Because they understand that life isn't only a full belly. The only way to understand that is when you do have a full belly. And if you don't, you're not so concerned about those other things. The issue of elephants in Africa and elsewhere is brought up. Many people in wealthy countries don't understand what it's like to have an elephant in your neighborhood. They think, wow, it'd be fun, and they think of Dumbo the elephant, it's cute, and flies and everything. But actual real elephants can be aggressive. They can destroy your crop. They can trample you to death. They can tear down your house. And if you're a very poor person on the very edge of survival, you're not going to consider the elephant cuddly or beautiful or noble or anything else. It's considered a pest. Better to find ways in which the elephant is something useful and valuable so people have an incentive to keep it. In this case, the tourism value, the ability of people to ride elephants as they do in Southeast Asia, the ability to go view the majesty of African elephants and pay huge amounts of money to stay in these lodges. So wealth itself has to be a part of this environmental solution. You have to be able to fund it, and you need a population wealthy enough to care, to really say, now that I have a full belly and my children are not dying in my arms, I can care about those other things.
I kind of agree, because coming from a developing economy, climate change issues, and especially the fear-mongering around climate change, I think has a huge impact on especially emerging economies and developing economies, because developing economies are reliant a lot on international, multilateral aid. And the agenda now is of green growth, which particularly I have no problems with, to think about achieving economic growth through probably trying to create the least environmental impact, which is a very good idea on paper. But what it does in terms of aid initiatives always target policy changes in developing countries. And what it does is it distorts the incentives in the market in developing economies. So I'll give you an example of windmills in Nepal. It's a completely unfeasible solution. Why? Because we have narrow mountainous roads. We can barely transport one windmill up the mountains. Yes, we do have winds, right? But we're not producing these. So we're, you know, importing them. Imagine the climate cost. These are shipped in containers, like traveled, transported through huge uses of fuel, for all in the name of renewable clean energy. And this comes all through development aid. And so suddenly, like, there are some young guys who are caught up in the imagination, wind entrepreneurs in Nepal, like, who are saying, like, oh, this is renewable energy, like the clean bill of health, and we want to do this thing. You're selling false aspirations. It's just not feasible, all in the name of green growth. So I think these fantastic ideas that come out here in the West, I think to be careful about transporting these ideas across borders. Is also, like Tom said, when you don't have a full belly, the first concern is how to get your belly full. Having said that, that doesn't mean local people don't care about the environment. I mean, farmers have to rely on having good environment so that their crops don't fail. So I think they're the ones who are most concerned about the environment at the end of the day. They have traditional knowledge of weather systems, and they realize this is changing due to climate change. So the question is more about climate adaptation. And in that sphere, as long as there's no intervention, both from aid agencies and the government in general, I think that is when local entrepreneurship will flourish. But the more you put in ideas of like, oh, this is probably a good idea because so-and-so country has windmills and that is the best form of renewable energy, whereas I think solar does very well in Nepal. But solar comes at a cost. It's the battery usage. How are you going to eventually dispose of these batteries that we've collected over a period of time? That's another climate cost that we haven't added up. So I think there are a lot of issues with climate change where we think one idea is a very good idea and try to run with it because we are so much in a hurry to solve all these issues at once. So your question about, okay, are there market solutions? If we sit down over here and start saying, this is the solution, we're no different from a planning agency in saying, like, here's how things should work.
So another, to your point about, you know, well, what's going to remove carbon from the atmosphere? And so a common comment by people who are somewhat skeptical of the need for emergency action is, I'll believe this when I see the people advocating it changing their behavior, right? So France banned flights of less than 2 hours, and you're going to take the train and say, well, someone went and checked, and they actually got rid of one flight, right? So there were exceptions, and there were this, and there was that, and so it ended up eliminating one flight, right? So this is not serious behavior. This is performance. This is political performance, and so we can't forget that any issue, however real it is also used in politics to gain an advantage. And so I think a lot of that fear comes from people using it for political purposes to gain an advantage in an upcoming election or in some other way. And what we don't see, right, is in wealthy countries, people actually changing their behavior in the way that they want people in developing countries in particular to do. We shouldn't forget the number one air pollution problem in the world is indoor air pollution in developing countries from people burning organic matter. This affects women and children the most because they're in the house cooking over burning animal dung, for example, right, in an open fire in a house. This is very deleterious to the health of women and children. And so electrification that allows them to have clean air in their homes is an incredibly important priority and one that we know how to do now. So we could make a dramatic increase in maternal health and in child health in many countries where life expectancy is far shorter than it is in developed countries by doing that. And if that means having more natural gas plants in those countries, that's a trade-off I think that we at least need to talk about, whether we can sacrifice the lives of those women and children, taking years and years off their lives and you're reducing their productivity. Having electricity means you can have a well. It means that you're not walking 4 hours a day to get water. These are all really important things, and there are things that we are talking about making trade-offs. One of the things that many environmental campaigners forget is that we are no longer at the point where it's a matter of stopping someone dumping a toxin into a river. That doesn't happen in the developed world much anymore, right? Or it happens by mistake. It's not a deliberate policy of a business to do that. Where it once was, it was a free disposal. Mm-hmm. Both in the United States and Germany, there were rivers zoned as essentially industrial sewers. So the famous Cuyahoga River fire in Cleveland, Ohio, where I used to live, which was a cause of the Clean Water Act in the United States, was the reports that a river had caught fire. Well, it turned out the river caught fire regularly because it's a very crooked river and debris caught on it, and it had been zoned as a sewer, and so there was all sorts of flammable stuff being poured into it, and somebody threw a cigarette off the bridge or a spark from a train or something set it off. The fire was so short that there wasn't even TV footage of it. So they used footage of an earlier fire when it became a cause celeb. But that was the result of attitudes that we no longer have, that it was appropriate to treat the waterways of a country as an industrial sewer. Nobody in the developed world does that anymore. Right? They're no longer rivers zoned to be sewers. Right? There might be people polluting those rivers. There might be problems that we need to address from large animal feeding, confined animal feeding operations, and things like that. They're all really hard problems. But all of these things involve trade-offs. They all involve, you can have more of this, but you get less of that. And that's actually where markets are really good, is at helping people solve trade-offs. And so politics is really bad at that. In fact, it's exceptionally bad and leads to very polarized political debates because I'm going to win or you're going to win. There's not going to be any trade-off made here. And so by using more market mechanisms, so you asked, you know, how are we going to solve get the carbon out of the atmosphere? I was just reading today, there's a mineral, whose name I forget, but a mineral is apparently a very cheap and expensive mineral. It's not good for it very much. But you know what it does? It absorbs carbon. And so someone said, well, we can buy a lot of this stuff. We can grind it up into sand, and we can throw it on beaches. And then it will absorb carbon, and the wave actions will abrade it further, and it will get smaller, and then it will sink in the oceans and take the carbon out. And this would be really cheap to do, at least on a trial basis. And so I'm going to bet that somebody like Ted Turner is going to see that story, some wealthy individual, and say, well, that sounds interesting. You know, how much would it cost to grind up a few tons of this? And you know, can we measure it? Can we test this? Can we see if this works? And those kind of solutions can be tried. We can play a strategy of many solutions if we decentralize these decisions. And governments can play a role in this. They can offer rewards. Who has the best solution? Right? Right now we have the government saying you will do X, Y, and Z. We will get rid of short-haul flights in France. Well, not actually, right? But we get some publicity. But what if the government instead said we'll put up 100 million euros for someone who figures out a cost-effective way of removing carbon from the atmosphere at some rate, right? That would be amazing. We don't spend a single euro if nobody does it. But if somebody does it, they get the 100 million euros. Well, there's going to be a ton of people out there innovating and working away at this. And then if we pay 100 million euros, well, that's fine. We got what we wanted. But if we don't get it, we don't pay. But instead, governments want to say, oh, we'll give a grant here, we'll put a mandate there. And there's no accountability when those things don't work. No one in France is going to lose their job because this policy of eliminating short-haul flights meant, except maybe the press secretary who let slip the real numbers, right? But no one's going to lose their job because this policy is a failure. But in the marketplace, if you don't succeed, you go out of business. And if only politics were more like that.
So then there is there is an incentive to allow market mechanism to also help discover better solutions. I mean, I think everybody agrees that it can't be the best idea to have a solution that has been developed over the last, 15 years, and then try to get it to everybody in the next 20 years without thinking about how these things could also improve. That we need to allow different solutions in different places. Every local community knows their possibilities and their environment the best, and they know what they can do, what skills they have, what, you know. So then there is a lot of opportunity to promote the idea of more markets, because markets are also, it's not only a system to produce things, to negotiate between property owners, negotiate good solutions and create win-win situation. It's also a great way to explore new possibilities. Right. So,
and
you need that freedom to explore things. Sometimes we can observe that now in science that, you know, we already established we need this and that technology. That's it. No need to research in other directions because we have found the best solution already. And I think that's something that makes us feel uneasy that the solution seems to be there already. When you are skeptic about it, that there's just one solution, you're criticized for not trying to help with the challenge that climate change is, or the warming planet is.
Let me just give you one more example that's based on data that some co-authors and I are analyzing right now. So we did a search of the European Patent Office's database of patents. So the European Patent Office, which is a collective effort of EU members and some other European countries, basically accumulates every patent in the world that's in electronic format. So it's sort of the sum of all patented knowledge. And we selected out of that all the patents dealing with solar photovoltaic technology and wind turbine technology. And so there's about 500,000 patent families for each of those things. So a patent family, if you patented the same thing in Germany and the United States, that would be one patent family, not two. It would be two patents, but one patent family. And we looked at which patent system the innovation was in, and we used a network analysis that's sort of intellectually equivalent to Google's PageRank algorithm. So it ranks patents by how they're more important if a more important patent cites them, right? So it's a sort of iterative calculation. But this has been validated by the people that developed it against other measures of value, and it holds up pretty well. And so the question is, the received wisdom is that on solar and wind, China has just been absolutely brilliant, and Europe has been brilliant, and the United States are idiots because we've let China and Europe steal the technological march on us because we don't have an industrial policy, we don't have the government putting money into this. The wise Chinese have poured government money into developing a solar industry, and particularly the clever Germans have really, you know, had this great forward-looking energy policy and so forth. And what we found, which really kind of surprised me, was that by orders of magnitude, the innovation is in the United States in both those technologies. It's not even close. There's no way to torture the data to make. So China's numbers of patents have gone up, but the quality has not. And so the best patents by every measure we've been able to come up with are in the United States. And so you might say, well, maybe these are Chinese companies patenting things in the United States, but why would they do that if, and we looked and if you're a Chinese company and you invent things in China, you have to patent it in China first. And so we could tell whether it's a Chinese invented thing being patented in the United States after the Chinese thing, and it's not. So all the innovation by just orders of magnitude, right? It's not a little effect. There's no nuance to this. It's just staggering how much innovation in those two key areas where the conventional wisdom, and if you read the solar literature, you read the wind literature, they all say, oh, the stupid Americans are not doing this. It turns out the market economy in the United States is driving innovation. And it's driving it in just the technology areas, right? New forms of the film that does the conversion from light to electricity and so forth like that. It's driving that. But it's driving it in every area. The only areas where China has a significant presence in the intellectual property in solar, for example, is in marginal incremental improvements in making existing solar panels with existing technology, which is they're very good at manufacturing inexpensively because they're heavily subsidized. But all of the innovation, all of it, is being driven in the United States. And so that says to me that a market system of rewarding success and punishing failure is actually what's driving the innovation we need if solar is going to make the leap it has to make. It has to get better if it's really going to meet our energy needs, right? It's the current efficiency levels of solar panels are not sufficient for it to meet the level of energy needs we need. We need, even people in the solar industry will tell you, we need to make a significant step up, and that's going to require doing things differently. And all of that stuff is happening in the U.S. intellectual property system, not in Europe, not in Japan, not in Korea, not in China, not anywhere else. And so that says to me that the most market-friendly of these systems, despite all of the policy successes claimed for these other places, is what's driving innovation. And that's the innovation we have to have.
I'm struggling that we are using the term market now too much. I'd rather say we use the term individual initiative or private initiative, because the markets is basically just a place where we get together to trade. This is a legal construct where we make arrangements and contracts. But what we're really talking about is that we need individual and private initiative to actually drive things, look for opportunities, make the best out of opportunities, benefit from these opportunities. Mm-hmm. And of course, America has a large advantage in that area because America had the tradition of letting individual and private initiative flourish. The universities have reached high levels of standards where they churn out talents that are actually able to go and create businesses. The certain states are better than other states in giving people the space to actually develop their ideas to a level where they can actually make profit with these ideas and create companies. So I think instead of using the word markets, it's also, by the way, a term in the free market environmentalism where I'm not quite happy with using the term free markets, because it's all what we're really talking about is that individuals and private initiatives really drive technology, drive ideas, and actually are allowed to benefit from them by creating a profit out of them.
People respond to incentives. You're absolutely right. And so here's just one more historical example. So in the 1930s, it was not a surprise to people that a war was coming. And so the oil refiners in the United States went to the U.S. military and said, look, there's probably going to be another war. We're probably going to be in it, and it's probably going to involve airplanes. And the military said, yes, we agree with you on all three of those things. And they said, what kind of aviation fuel are you going to need for those airplanes, which you haven't designed yet? And the military thought about it, and they came back and said, we need 100-octane fuel. That would be the sweet spot for performance, that we think we can really design excellent planes if we had 100-octane fuel. At that time, 100-octane fuel was a reference chemical sold in little vials at a very high price. And the oil refiners said, well, we don't know how we're going to do it, but you tell us how much you want and how much you'll pay for it, and we'll figure out how to do it. And they did. In just a few years, 100-octane fuel was very inexpensive, very commonly available, and was fueled, it was made at a couple refineries in the U.S. and in the Caribbean, in the Dutch territories in the Caribbean. And this was why Britain won the Battle of Britain, because that 100-octane fuel upped the performance level of the planes. And so that's an example of how an incentive, a relatively simple incentive, if you can, we will buy this many 100,000 million gallons of fuel at this price 5 years from now. And they said, okay. And they went back, and their scientists changed the refining industry dramatically. It wasn't an incremental improvement in refining. It was a phase shift in refining technology. New things were came up with in that short period because someone held out the reward. The same thing, we can see the same thing with the space program now, right? Elon Musk and other private entrepreneurs have transformed space technology, right? I use Starlink at home, right? It's incredible. Our ranch is out in the middle of nowhere. There's no one's ever going to run a fiber optic line out there. It would be prohibitively expensive. But now we have a satellite dish, and we can stream video because he figured out how to launch hundreds of thousands of satellites. And he actually tapped into a government incentive program to provide internet to people in rural areas. And it's been transformative, not just in the United States, but in other places like Ukraine during the war. So I think we undervalue what individuals can do if you just give them an incentive and then get out of their way and let entrepreneurs go to work.
But that's very... That's a very hard thing to do, to get out of the way for those who would love to do something because they see there's a problem, but maybe don't have the opportunity or possibility or the skill to become an entrepreneur and come up with solutions. And so they need something that they can trust, and they rather trust the government to say, we will have this by doing that in that year in the future. But because it seems to be more likely than to just trust the ingenuity of other people.
There's an unfortunate human predisposition, I think it may be hardwired into us, to prefer to have a boss. Mm. We want a boss. And it's the same mentality that says, oh my gosh, we can't just trust all those people out there. You need to have a king. The king will solve these things. It's the same criticism of democracy. Oh my God, all these ignorant people around me yammering away and chatting, just make sure the king has the power to solve the problems. And it's difficult to break ourselves from that. Maybe it's come from being raised by parents, and as children we look up to them to solve our problems. But to understand that you don't need a boss, you don't need a king to sort out these difficult problems. There's a wisdom of crowds. A whole bunch of people discussing it can often come up with a much better solution than just picking one person and saying, you, over there, you get to be the dictator, whether it's a democratic solution or a market solution to some particular problem. So democracy and markets share this common feature of relying on the wisdom of many people in interacting with each other, correcting each other, saying, pointing out why someone is, you think, wrong or has made a mistake, doing so in a civil way. So competing in the market economy by coming up with a better product than the other person, than the other firm, than the other competitor, and not assuming, well, we've already worked out the one solution and everybody's going to get it. So there's a kind of psychological transformation that I think is required for appreciating democracy and appreciating the market economy, to give up this idea of looking to mom and dad to solve our problems. We have to solve them ourselves and with each other in cooperative manners.
The other thing is, who got us into this mess, right? People have been talking about climate change for decades now, right? This started coming up. I can remember the covers of Time magazine in the 70s, but it really became a topic of conversation over 20 years ago. And what have governments delivered?
if this is really a crisis, we need people who can move faster than governments seem to be able to do. They're still holding international conferences to talk about what to do, and they're not doing anything. So if we want action, I think we have to look at the market.
I think the demographics is changing. The voter population is changing. We're looking at a younger generation who get a lot of facts from probably social media. There's a lot of misinformation out there. And so to demand the government is the easiest solution, probably, if you're sitting on your armchair on a phone and you really, you know, have to, like, click a button to say you disapprove or approve of a certain action or a policy. You know, because a lot of people you know are making that noise, and we all live in our echo chambers to a large extent. We like hearing things we sort of have belief systems about. And it's easier for a generation that's very, very highly engaged with social media, because there are so many things on social media. I guess in order to give enough attention, your attention span on a particular item is small enough that you just gather the surface information out of it, right? And then you form your opinion based on, like, this surface information that you've gathered for some period of time. So I think even participating in democracy and how things will change, or, like, you know, people who want to do things, going forward, I understand that it's difficult to understand something that's invisible, something that nobody knows where the solution is going to come from. And we're saying, trust the system, the solution is going to come from somewhere, from private initiative. It's a difficult thing, and it's very, for a lot of people, sort of counterintuitive, because here's all this information, here are so-called experts coming on, like, from left, right, and center, and saying, like, the world's doomed, so who should I believe more? So I get it that probably democratic outcomes is actually going to be government making a lot of these policy resolutions. But with policy resolutions, whether they get implemented or not, is if they are practical enough, if they are implementable enough, they will be. Otherwise, it's just like any other regulation that's written on a piece of paper, but people find ways to circumvent it anyways, and would be an ineffective regulation at the end of the day. And at the end of the day, what is going to work is some private initiative coming out with a solution and become so popular. And then suddenly people look back at the regulation and say, why did we write that? Like, why aren't we changing to that? And even that change is going to take some time. So I think change process is just, that's how it works.
So you are rather optimistic in a way, that even though we can't see it, we cannot engineer it into the future. So you still have the trust that something will develop if people are given the space and the freedom to find their own solution, and then on the long run, the good solutions, they will find followers in a way they say, oh, that's a great solution, it could work for me, I'll adapt that too. I mean, looking at the time, and I would really like to end on that positive note, a bit more positive note. So I suggest to do one last round, maybe. So what is that, and maybe Rainer, you can start, and Apita comes last, because you just somehow soft started this round. What is your maybe gut feeling or educated guess towards how what will probably lead to a betterment and improvement of our situation with regard to climate change?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Peter started talking about it, and I really have an understanding for the young people today who are really worried about what's going to happen. Yeah. They see all the developments with the temperatures and so on, and they're really worried about what's going to happen to the planet. When I grew up, it was the Cold War. We were really worried that we would be caught in a war between the Soviet Union and the United States. That was a real worry that we had when I grew up, and I understand that the kids nowadays, they would be worried about that. But I guess around this table here, we're all classical liberals, liberals in the European sense. And what defines us is a trust in human ingenuity, as you also just put it just now. The trust that if we put our heads together and we have the freedom to actually do that and come up with solutions, we can actually do that. And so I believe, you know, really if we let that human ingenuity to unfold, we will be able to find those solutions. Local ones, small ones, not the big picture solution, but we've seen a lot of signs that people are actually able to contribute to solving the big issues, and I don't think there's any alternative anyway. So I stay positive, and I believe through programs like this one here in the IAF, you know, when we put people from 22 countries together, discuss how to actually solve certain problems, we will eventually succeed.
So I'm optimistic as well. I think the economist Julian Simon wrote a book called The Ultimate Resource, in which he said humanity is the ultimate resource. And so somewhere out there, there's a 20-year-old studying engineering who's going to come up with some incredibly clever thing that's going to make a difference. And there's probably 100,000 of them right now working on something. And so we don't know what the solution is. If we knew solutions, right, it'd be easy. We just do it. So that probably nobody knows what the solution is. But humanity's incredible, innovative ability to adapt, to see creatively, to see something that other people can't see, that's what I'm banking on. And that's what's going to keep the world getting to be a better place. If you compare the sort of world in the last 200 years, right, there's been a more than 12-fold increase in human well-being. I mean, we can measure through skeletal remains and stuff, sort of, you know, sort of basic levels of nutrition going back for centuries and so forth. And everybody in the world lived at about, you know, it's called a level of one. So if you were emperor of China 1,000 years ago, maybe you're a 1.05. And if you were a peasant in a place experiencing a famine, maybe you were a 0.92. But everybody was pretty much equally poorly off. And then something happened, and we got this virtuous cycle going, and people began to do things that have led to an incredible enrichment of our lives. And I think that's just going to continue, as long as we don't get in the way. And part of the reason, the economist Deirdre McCluskey says that that happened, was the culture of rewarding entrepreneurship took hold, the culture of seeing being an innovator and being a business person and so forth as morally worthy. And that's what I'm afraid we're losing in this concern is leading us to devalue the very thing that is going to save us.
Well, I'm generally optimistic. Let me introduce a note of caution. I think that we have seen over the last 17 years, according to Freedom House, a democratic retreat in much of the world. It's uneven country to country, but overall our side, the side of democracy, has been in retreat. We've seen a good 20-year decline in the Human Freedom Index globally, so it's been increasing in some countries and on some issues and not on others. But looking at the aggregate, this has not been a good two decades in some regards for the fundamental foundations. Now, economic growth and social progress have continued, but it's a kind of momentum that has moved it forward as living standards have risen. We have all kinds of new life-saving devices, medicines, and so on. But what happens if the engine underneath that, which is basically liberal democracy, is strangled? And I think that we have to have a real commitment to these principles of liberal democracy. They are under attack. And we have to defend them. And with that, that means the whole system of decentralized decision-making, of autonomous persons who have agency to make decisions about their lives. That's the market economy. It's the system of freedom of speech and free inquiry. It's freedom of religion. And it's democratic pluralism. That's the key. And if we do want this forward motion of social progress, of uplift, of rising living standards, and the ability to address these environmental amenities and serious problems, we have to make sure that the foundation isn't eroded or eaten away. And that means some return to the fundamental questions of how people live together as free persons. So I'm very focused on renewing the foundations of social progress, and that is liberalism and democracy.
Yeah, I agree very much. But one reason that makes me very optimistic is perhaps the country I come from, which might surprise all of you, because I think we have a very young population. Well, we do have a, so demographically speaking, we are yet to get the demographic dividend. So in general, we have a very young population base. A young population base that is not scared of hard work, because we live in difficult conditions. In order to survive, you have to work hard. And so there are brilliant local innovations coming up, even when you're, because you need to survive in a very difficult environment. It's a stifling environment, regulatory speaking, but we are experimenting with federalism. We're learning how to make it work. We're building institutions. Some work, some don't. Most don't. So we're working in this environment, and despite that, at the local level, you see initiatives happening that you just don't think of. And that is human ingenuity coming in the forefront and, you know, dealing with these problems on a day-to-day basis. So, yeah, I think my faith and optimism comes from that, is saying, despite this so difficult environment you work in, to survive in, as in Nepal is, people are making, not just making do, people are trying to break those barriers, you know, move forward. So that gives me a lot of hope.
Thank you very much. That was a wonderful round. Of course, talking about big challenges and problems and so on, and I know you cannot just snap finger, come up with a brilliant solution, because if that was that easy, we would have that already. But also thank you, Tom, for pointing out again that it's not just about talking about one challenge. We also need to think about what is the framework that allows for us humans to deal with these challenges, and that's how do we want to live together, how do we want to cooperate in the future across countries, across cultures, to come up with good solutions for all of us, especially when we talk about global problems. So thank you very much. It's been a wonderful experience, and hope to see you again, maybe in this round, maybe in another. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Regina.